Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Sour and Sass. I am very excited to be joined by Jeff Perkins, CMO and Head of Product at Park Mobile. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thanks, Garrett. Great to be with you. That was by far the best opening I've ever been a part of in any of these marketing shows. That was awesome. I love it.
Oh, thank you. Let me get our guy on here. Yo, Adam, let me see your face for a second, man. You just got a shout out. The man behind the scenes. Thank you, Adam. Good work, man. Well, I got to vent my customer. I treated you like customer success in the pre-interview because Park Mobile is like one of my favorite apps of late, because every time I go surfing, I get to use it. Now, we had some good conversations offline, and one of the things I'm most curious about you when I was prepping and looking at your website is, how do you think about designing a website for consumers who are trying to download the Park Mobile app while simultaneously trying to sell new parking providers? How in your mind do you think of balancing that? And because I noticed you did some cheeky things, like you have only get a demo once I get into the subfolder of your B2B side of your business. Because I could imagine if you had get a demo at the top and I'm trying to find a parking spot, that causes problems. So like, how do you decide these things?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of ways to approach it. And it's pretty interesting when you have a consumer brand and a B2B brand and you're selling, you want consumers to download the app or start parking, and then you need B2B guys to submit a lead form. You know, and some companies just say, like, we're just going to break up the websites and do them totally separately, right? And so you see that a lot where those hybrid companies kind of have their B2C site and their B2B site. We felt like we can do it all together. But we just have very strong definitions of, are you a parking provider?
Yeah.
Go here. Right.
No, you did. And
we've had to play with it a lot. And, you know, the last thing we want is our sales guys getting a lot of consumer inquiries too.
Yeah.
So it's been kind of a learning curve, but I think we've kind of figured it out. We're constantly optimizing, making tweaks to the website to make sure we're getting people to where they need to go. And like one example is, so we put chat on the B2B section of the website. And sometimes though, consumers will stumble in there. And so our sales guys are managing like conversations with angry consumers because of them in the app. But overall, I think we've figured out those right paths. And it goes to kind of something that's important whenever you're working on a website, is the constant testing and optimization to make sure people are getting to the content you want them to get to. And it's as easy a process as possible.
Now, before we get to content, because I have some questions on that, are there any other learnings that you could maybe help anyone tuning in today to avoid? Because first off, I want to commend, like, I love your idea of B2C and B2B on the same domain. It allows essentially all that direct traffic, all that PR, all of the B2C, the mass play, which is why we all love freemium products and marketing, things like that, to help your B2B business. So first off, I love the decision to keep it together. I think that gives you so much more leverage for your B2B marketing, and you don't have to separate it. It feels like the two can work together. But what other learnings, if someone's trying to do that, and they have like a lot of market share on B2C, what else did you learn of like how to kind of create separate paths for people?
Yeah, I think probably the big things are using the tooling that's out there to really figure out, you know, and study what people are doing. What are the main areas they're clicking on your website? And then moving things around to make sure you're optimizing for that. It's interesting. We used to have, are you a parking provider, in a very prominent position on the website. It's been kind of an ongoing journey where, what's the right place where we're making it easy for the B2B customers to find us, but we're not making a path where maybe a consumer will find their way there. And then
you did it below the fold now, right? What I saw was like a module below the fold. I thought it was brilliant. I did.
And that became the kind of the sweet spot to maximizing the number of B2B users who are visiting those sections, while at the same time minimizing consumers accidentally finding themselves there. So that's been kind of the exercise. I mean, for people that are trying to do this, I think I always recommend, you know, using tools like Crazy Egg or Optimizely, things that let you test different things on the fly, things that show you analytically what people are clicking on, even doing things through like usertesting.com, where you could set up some experiments and watch people as they're going through the site, watch either consumers or B2B clients as they're going through the site, make sure they can get to where you want them to get to as easily as possible. So, but I think you're right. I mean, when you know, when you have everything under one domain, it just works a lot harder for you in the search engines. You're able to create, you know, just it just, you know, increases your domain authority. It's just I think a better way to go. And you just need to make sure, and, you know, companies, a lot of companies do this, like Uber does it really well, because, you know, when you're going to uber.com, you're either a passenger or a driver, right? And we looked at a lot of those cases and modeled what we were doing after some of those companies, just to make sure we were really, you know, implementing all the best practices when it comes to this.
No, and it is interesting because, like, if you look at Uber, right, they're leading straight with the drivers now, even over the ride. And I think it's because of their brand and the amount of app downloads they have. Mm-hmm. Now, something interesting for you that I was curious about is you don't let me download from app or Android in one click. You have me submit my phone number and then you text me the link. Why is that? Like, why not just like the app click link? Is there any reason for that?
Yeah, well, that's really built for people that are, it's different experiences on mobile browser versus desktop. So you were on a desktop, you click download the app. It probably said, you know, give us your number.
Correct. Yeah, it did. And I was like, why aren't they using the app buttons? But you're right. It would download them to my computer, my phone.
So if you're on the mobile web, it pushes you right to the app store where you download. So it's just, you know, so we really... which is important. You have to take into account the type of browser someone is looking at the website, right? Because, you know, if you're on a desktop, you have to have a bit of a different experience than if you're on a mobile web, to make sure you're surfacing the right information, making sure the menus that are showing up are appropriate to the mobile web experience versus the desktop experience.
That's such a cool thing, especially because if you think about this, it's a tangent slightly to your use case, but like, product-led growth, right? All these SaaS companies want to do product-led growth, and they now have all these like product tours and things you can do. But if that's your call to action on mobile, I bet you it's probably a pretty crappy experience trying to do a product tour on your iPhone compared to, it's interesting. I wonder if more SaaS companies should change what their call to actions are based on device.
You definitely have to make it device appropriate, but you also... you have to look at it, and this is something that whether you use Google Analytics or whatever tools you have, look at the usage of your website based on device, right? So, because we're an app-based business, about 80% of our website traffic is coming in on mobile devices, okay? So only 20% are actually doing what you do and viewing through the desktop. And so we need to make sure that we kind of take a mobile-first approach in our web experience.
As you should, right?
Yeah, because that's where the majority of users are viewing the site from. And so when you look at the site on a mobile browser, you'll notice, it's a really nice site on a mobile browser, really easy to use. And then on the web, the web gives you kind of a broader experience, surfaces more content, which it should. So it's just two different. It's really different paths for different users depending on the type of devices that they're accessing with.
I'm curious. I don't know if you have this data, but are you able to see what percent of users directly, like, so like I'm surfing, right? I drive into Newport Beach, I park. I'm like, oh crap, I got to go to the thing. I'm like, oh, real, it's dope. It's a Park Mobile one. Like, that's actually how my brain works. Like, okay, silly, they got the app. I don't have to go do the whole thing. Well, I just went to the App Store and downloaded the app. What percent of users in your mind go directly to the App Store and download Park Mobile versus people who go to parkmobile.com and then download?
It's a high percentage start at the web experience.
They do. They don't just go directly to the app. They don't just search the App Store.
So what the most common path that we see, because most people, when they first use Park Mobile, they're at the parking spot.
Correct. And they have a need.
Moment of need. They see the sign. Right, they see the green sign, and by the way, the green sign is the greatest marketing tactic. You know, one of the great marketing tactics I've ever been involved in. Like, those signs, it's like when we do our brand awareness studies, the number one way people learn about Park Mobile by far, signage. So all our fancy digital ads.
How do you get the signage approved with the cities, though? Isn't that a nightmare?
No, the cities want the signage up because they want to drive mobile adoption. So it, but what's great for us is those signs, and we have millions of signs around the country because we're in 450 cities, right? And so we have basically millions of mini billboards in every city we're in. And people are like, hey, green, Park Mobile green. I see those Park Mobile green, and they pop really. That's why they're really that bright green.
Do you pay for the signs, or do the signs, is it just the initial cost of the actual signage and installation, or how do you think about the cost of that?
Yeah. So it's just the cost to print them and install them.
Oh my God. So it's a full sunk cost advertising. It's like the definition of SEO, but in the physical world.
Yeah, but it's a win-win for us in the city because the city wants to drive mobile adoption. Right? They want more people playing on the mobile app because that just means there's more. It's easier for them to get paid. There's credit card. The money funds go right to them. They don't have to have a someone checking the meters for coins. So the more mobile adoption, the better. Also for many cities, they have visions of getting more meters off the sidewalk to open up the sidewalks more. Right. So the more mobile adoption, the fewer meters you need as a city.
Less hardware, less maintenance, less operators.
Yeah. And so they love putting our signage up on poles or just stickers on the meters to make sure that people know that mobile pay is available in this area. And so then people see that sign, they say, oh, Park Mobile, cool. Google Park Mobile, or just type Park Mobile right into the browser. So either way, they're usually getting to parkmobile.io. And which is our website, and they get there, quick click off to the app store often. Or what's new for us is that we launched a mobile web version of our app as well. So right in that mobile browser now, if you don't want to download a full featured app, you just click enter your zone number, and you go through a mobile web experience, and you could check out with like a guest checkout process if you don't want to go through the process of setting up an account.
I love that. Now, were you involved in creating the site?
Oh yeah. Yeah. So the marketing team, we have a design group within our marketing team, and they build all the signage out. And so we spend a lot of time though, making sure, the signs are effective. They're communicating what they need to communicate. There's always this a little bit of art and science between how much content you put on the sign, how much is too much, how much is too little. But what the big pieces of it are, that zone number and the Park Mobile logo and the green color, those three elements are the ones that are really important. But we've recently added some elements to the signs, which are cool. So we added like a text to pay option. So if you don't want to go to the website, you could just text a number, send you a link, right? We added QR code. So now scan the QR code, get right into the flow, or download the app. So just offering basically more ways to pay than there have been in the past. Because one of the complaints we get for the app is that, people are ready to park. Okay, I got to download the app. Okay, I got to set up the account. That's it's a very common complaint. It's like, you're familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yeah.
Every time you fulfill a need, there's a bigger need. So it used to be people hated paying at the meters with coins, right? They're like, I want to pay with credit card. So then all the hardware companies said, okay, now you can pay with credit cards. They'll be like, I don't want to pay with credit card. I want to pay on an app. And so then Park Mobile comes in and is like, okay, now you can pay on an app. They'll be like, I don't want to pay on an app. I want to pay on a mobile web browser.
And so it's just you keep evolving to this what's easiest. Now, I have a thing that I'm very curious about because there is one flaw I have with the app, and that's I can never remember when you're in a city and you're in Newport, and I want to know what your psychologist is. I'm parking in a Blackie's, let's say, in one parking lot. And it's a different zone though if I park on 54th, and I really struggle and I get the numbers confused when I'm in the app. How did you all think of the numbering of the zones? Because it's like 9617, then the one's like 9676, and then my brain gets twisted. How did you guys come up with numbering it? I'm so curious on this. And that's why I was so excited. Like, I was like, what's the insides of like, how do we choose? Like, cause you didn't use any letters. Right. So in my mind, like a letter could have helped me. I was just curious. Like, well, how do you guys think of it?
It's a highly scientific process.
I thought it would be
where we select a number, and then it goes in sequential order. So if it's 50001, then the next is 5002. So it's not a big science. Usually, we work closely with the city, and we say, all right, where are all the parking zones we're going to set up.
And well, I'm always terrified I'll put the wrong zone in.
Yeah.
So I'm like,
yeah.
Oh, is it that zone or is it that? You're like, oh no, I messed up the zone. So I'll go over and I'll walk back over to the sign and I'll be like, okay, no, I'm good.
Yeah. It's in sequential order. You know, usually what we try to do is, you know, not have the same zone, like a similar zone number on the same block, just to get people confused. Sometimes it doesn't always work out, but yeah, it's usually just a sequential order. You know, I always advise people, you know, because the way we set it up, we try to make it as fast as possible to pay and get out of the app, but we have this confirmation screen, and I always tell people, I was like, you got to just double check on the confirmation screen. You got to double check two things: the right zone number, and you've paid for the right car, because the way they identify whether or not you paid is by license plate. Okay. And if you're like me, I have a couple different cars in my parking
lot. I have my wife's car and have my car on the app.
Yeah. And I have paid for the wrong car and I've gotten a ticket before. And
that's gotta be a fun moment, Jeff, when it's your own app and you're just like, I'm telling you, the moment in your defense and in Park Mobile's defense, the lowest form of human intelligence is when you're in a parking lot. Like, I do believe, like, we are at our dumbest as society in parking lots. And, like, I don't know, like, my brain all of a sudden can't keep the numbers straight. We mess up the cars. Like, we're geniuses until we get in that. Have you ever seen the people, too, trying to figure out the old school apps? You know, like, it is hilarious. Our brains just lose all cognitive function in the parking lots.
Yeah, it's just one of those things. But if you get the wrong license plate number, then – the guys who are enforcing parking there, they have no way of knowing that you actually paid. And it's, you know, you may get a ticket if you're, if you don't time it right. So yeah, those are always my two pieces of, like, always check the zone number and check the license plate number. And, you know, hopefully there's no issue from there. Cause so it's weird. Like, I'm pretty active on social media. And so whenever people complain, they don't just complain to Park Mobile, they complain to me personally.
I love that they find you.
They find me. And so, but I would say 9 times out of 10, the issue is related to either the wrong zone number entered or the wrong license plate entered. And, you know, usually it's, you know, after we kind of go back and forth a little bit, they realize it was a little bit of a user error.
100%. Yeah, just always eager to get where we're going.
Right. Oh.
It's 100% it now. It is sour and sass, and I've been laughing and having so much fun that I haven't eaten any sour candy. Are you ready?
All right. I'm going to go going lemon. What are you going with?
Oh, my God. I opened it beforehand, but I forget. I'm going to say it's apple. Oh, that one's sour. Now, you have done two things I'm curious about. The first one's you. Your head of product.
All right.
What do you do? I don't know anything about product. Like, bring me into the product world, because I get the marketing world.
Right.
All right. How do you combine the two? I think you should. Right?
Everybody's going product. No, I don't know if you have product either. No. I joined Park Mobile in 2017. Last year, beginning of 2020, we had some changes in the leadership team. Our head of product left. And our CEO asked me to step in to add that to my portfolio. Okay. And I was actually excited to do it, because one thing I've always learned in my career is that you advance your career in your company by expanding your portfolio of work. I mean, that's really, yeah. And I'm a little bit ADD, so I like new challenges. And so that kind of worked for me too. But we had a good product team that was already in place, some really talented people. I think there's a lot of similarity between marketing and product, right? What is marketing all about? Understanding who the consumer or the customer is, building programs to reach and influence that consumer or customer. Product's very similar in a way. It's who's the consumer, who's the customer, what are their needs in relation to product?
Yeah.
And then working with engineering to build products that meet their needs. You know, at Park Mobile, we want to really be very close to the consumer and our customer and build solutions for them. So it did make a lot of sense, I think, to have, you know, me step in to lead up the product team, because we're so focused on building solutions that meet the needs of our customers and consumers.
not to be a cynic, Jeff, but I mean, we all say that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're living it. And the reason I'm saying that is like, we all say that. Every marketer, every CMO goes, you know, as long as you keep those customers, you know, stuff front and center, but they're so disconnected from product that they're lying and they don't realize they're lying. They're not trying to lie. It's that they're so disconnected. So it's actually one of the things I struggle with as a CEO at Directive is I run an agency. The agency is being very successful. Yet our point of existence isn't for our own success. It's for our client's success.
Right.
And so I'm rebuilding the culture around client success, because what happens is if agencies get bigger and they become more successful, the agencies become about the agency. The same goes with companies, right? Like Park Mobile starts ending up being more about Park Mobile than it does about helping me find parking.
Right. Right.
It happens, especially with success, because the money starts flowing. You get really focused on culture, especially as you grow, and it becomes Park Mobile about Park Mobile. What I think is so cool is when you share both titles, you get to do marketing with what it's supposed to be, right? Which is help. Your whole point of marketing is helping more people find parking, or more parking people find a better solution to offer parking, right? Like, so what have you set as your central KPI to connect your product team with your marketing team?
Yeah.
Like, for example, I do it as North Star Metric Attainment. So like, what percent of my clients hit the goals they set out to accomplish when they hired us?
Right, right.
For you, how do you think about combining product growth and marketing success so you share a KPI? Do you have anything like that?
We do. So a lot of the key metrics that we drive the business by are, you know, acquisition and retention. And this is on the consumer side, right?
Yeah.
And those are two things that are where product and marketing need to be attached to the hip. And I'll give you some examples. You know, we convert a pretty high percentage of our downloads into accounts and accounts into transactions.
Yeah.
And so we're often patting ourselves on the back, like, hey, we got the people through the sign up process. Well, they sign up, but you know, so it's about, I mean, it's in the 80% range of people creating an account to doing a transaction. That's really high for mobile apps.
Yeah, because your need is so high. That's what I love about it. It's like, well, what are they going to do? Get a ticket?
Yeah.
Like you have built in like consequences for not fulfilling, right? Which is so cool.
Right. But all right. So you look at that and you say, all right, we're doing great there. But hey, if we eke out another 1-3% at the volumes of users, we add a million new users every 2 months, basically.
So
if we can eke out 1-3%, go from 80 to 83 on conversion from account creation to transaction, that is serious revenue for the company. Okay. Yeah. So a lot of our metrics on the acquisition side, it's not just about getting mass downloads. It's about how many of those downloads convert into a transaction, and then doing programs, both, you know, marketing programs. So a lot of the breaking points where people won't do a transaction are related to, oh, I problem with my credit card setup, problem with, there's some issue there. So then the marketing team has been doing constant messaging. So if you download an account, gave us an email address, but didn't do a transaction, that's when our marketing machine kicks in and say, hey, we saw you downloaded, but you haven't set up your credit card. We saw you downloaded, you haven't added a car. And as we've been doing those kind of things in the user experience, it's really started to move the needle on our conversion of downloads to transactions. So that's on the acquisition side. Then
who is the enemy though, then, Jeff, on the acquisition side? Is the enemy the meter? Who's the enemy? Is it apathy? Is it the meter? Like who are you? Like, do you got what I'm saying? Because like technically you're competing with the meter, right? In this moment.
Yep. Yeah. It's kind of I actually think the people who don't convert download the app but don't have the occasion to park. So that's what our research has indicated.
Okay, so it's not that, so they're not. So they're like, so like me, when I go to Blackie's, I have the app and I just drive around because I can't find a spot. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, it could be that. Or it could be, you know, one of our biggest download days for the app is Saturday. But Saturday is a lower volume day for transactions overall. So you don't have as many people parking because it's a weekend. But a lot of people are downloading the app and they're downloading it because maybe they're planning a trip somewhere and they know that that place accepts Park Mobile. Or they're just, you know, they're on the app store and they're like, oh, what's a popular app? And they see Park Mobile, like, that's cool. they might see an article or a news spot on TV saying Park Mobile is coming to the neighborhood. And so there's some stimulus that is getting them to download the app, but they're not in the point of parking. And so they don't maybe finish the account and do the transaction. And so what we want to make sure they do through that process is just a few things. You know, make sure they've got all the information into the system so that they'll be ready when, you know, so credit card and the car setup. And the other part is then starting to let them know all the places around them where they can use Park Mobile. And that's big too. Like, oh, I didn't know I could use it at the local mall, or I didn't know it was available at the zoo, or I didn't know I could make a reservation at the stadium near me. So then it's starting to educate them on all the places they can use Park Mobile. And so as we've been doing more of those programs, that's just driven, you know, it, and again, it's not, we're not increasing conversions from, you know, from 50 to 100, but those inches that we're getting equate to significant revenue over the course of 12 months. And so that's kind of a big area where product and marketing are working together. The other is on retention though. You know, so like most mobile apps, people use once and then you lose a high percentage of them. Correct. And so, okay, what do you need to do there? And so then it's a lot of programs to make sure that we are going and reactivating dormant users, right? So you haven't used the app in 6 months. Hey, remember us, Park Mobile. We love you still. Come back. And then also we found a major point when people were leaving the app was when their credit card expires. So now we have all kinds of campaigns going to make sure people are updating their credit card if we know it's going to expire soon. So it's those kind of things that are going to drive higher retention for us over time and are going to keep people using us.
I have a question for you, Effin. Yeah. I got into the weeds here, so I want to hear what your take is. So you're doing something interesting. You're charging 99 cents for a pro version of the app that has some major utility, primarily that you can see what parking spots are available. What I found unique and I was curious about is, wouldn't you make more money increasing app usage by increasing the utility of the app and ungating available parking spots so that then you could drive up app usage by a greater rate than the 99 cents? Or how do you think about that? Like, cause I was thinking about this a lot. I was like, okay, they're monetizing the app now, not just using it as like a chicken and the egg to get the B2B business. But wouldn't it be more effective if it's an app that we're making transaction fees on to then increase the utility of the app so that people are using it to discover new parking? Couldn't I drive more? I don't know. I just had this crazy idea while you're talking because I did a bunch of prep for this. So I was curious.
Yeah, I think that's eventually where we're going to be. So if you think about it, like when a new car comes off the line, that new car always has the most stuff in it, right? Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like, oh, this car has nav and Wi-Fi and backup camera and sensors and all this stuff. And you got to get, and it's the premium model, right? And and then as that car has been out for a while, those premium features go into the base model, right? And so then you don't have to pay. Like now, I mean, you almost can't get a car without a backup camera anymore.
That or used to be, automatic windows, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, those used to be things you had to pay a premium for. And so the parking availability feature is kind of like that, where we're having people pay for it now, but over time that'll go into the base product. And then the question is, what do we replace it with in our premium product? And so we're looking at a couple things now that are super exciting around loyalty. So you park, you accrue points, you could use those points to get.
Maybe, no, you're doing some really cool stuff on it. I was just so curious when you told me, like, that's why I asked, I think earlier offline, I said, how do you make your money? And when you said transaction, that's what I was like, ooh, like, could we drive more app usage if, that's just where my brain went. I was just super curious. Yeah. Now, in closing, how do you think about advertising to parking? Like, who's your POC? Like, is it a parking? It's not a parking attendant. Is it a facilities manager? How do you even do ads? Do you let the B2C drive that? Like, how do you guys drive the B2B demand when you have a B2C product?
Yeah. So the industry we work in from a B2B point of view, it's the parking industry. So it's pretty small in a way as far as working in industry, right?
Because it's so focused around your ICP.
Yeah. So like my last company was called QA Symphony. It's now called Tricentis. But so that company was in the software testing space. So they had a software, they did software for QA testers basically. So who makes software? Every company in the country makes software, basically. So it's like we could sell to anyone. So it was really hard to figure out, all right, who do we
brutal.
Whereas, you know, in parking, it's a lot easier. We want to talk to people who work in parking. So that could be parking operators. There are a lot of large companies that do parking operations. They we want to talk to cities that have parking. We want to talk to event venues, convention centers, school, colleges, and universities. So anyone who is selling parking, we want to talk to. But a lot of those people are part of this parking community. And so, you know, we have, you know, basically three big trade shows every year for the parking industry. We have three major magazines for the parking industry. And then there's a lot of regional events and other things. But, you know, really the focus for us is on making sure we're in the conversation at all those events. So we do advertising and trade publications. We go to the trade shows. But because it's so targeted, it, you know, it's easier than in a lot of other categories to reach the people you want to reach, which is, you know, so it makes.
How do they charge a premium though, Jeff? So how do you swallow paying so freaking much for these? Because like me, I do the same thing. I only serve SaaS, right? So right. I go hit up Saster. I'm like, I want to advertise on your podcast. And it is not like they're just like, oh, well, yeah. Since we have such a focused audience, we'd love to give you an affordable CPM. No, like. They are just milking us dry. Everybody's like, you know, like the watering hole advertisers, the ones who really own a watering hole.
Yeah,
they're just charging a premium. How do you deal with that? Do you just like eat it and say it makes sense, or like?
Yeah, you know, the way we look at it, it's like if we want to be in front of people who work in parking, we need to be in these publications. Now, the parking publications and the trade shows are nowhere near as expensive as going to like the Saster conference or the Salesforce conference or the Serious Decisions conference. I mean, I know what that costs. It's absurd. I actually feel bad for the companies that have to compete in MarTech or sales tech or any of those categories, because it's so expensive. You know, our category I feel is very reasonable to do ads and to.
It's called that blue collar energy, kind of like a window washing type conference, or like a. Do you know what I'm talking about? Because I have friends in those spaces too. Is it similar to that more blue collar esque type field?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I would quite describe it as blue collar esque, but it's small. It's a small industry. So when you're in a small industry, I mean, it's funny because it's small, but parking is huge. I mean, there's parking everywhere, but the industry itself and the people who work in the industry, it's not. You know, it's thousands of people, so, you know, not hundreds of thousands. So it ends up being, you know, the publications and the advertising options are limited, and they're, you know, and because you're only reaching a couple thousand people, they can't charge you what, you know, Saster could charge you for events. So, you know, you're fortunate, but you know, I've been where you are too, where, you know, it's, you know, my last company was like, Gartner came calling about a trade show.
Forrester,
you know, like six figure investment. And I mean, when you're a small shop, that becomes a huge part of your budget. And so, you know, with any marketing investment you're going to make, I mean, you can't fall in love with like the brand name of what you're spending on. You have to look at, okay, did we get anything out of this? Yeah. Was this worth the investment?
And how do you measure that though with like a trade publication in your mind? Because like I think a lot of our clients struggle with that. Like, how are you measuring the ROI of a trade publication in your mind?
Yeah, so we probably don't. The trade publications we look at is just more of just keeping our leadership presence in the industry. So, but I would actually say the cost to do that is not so much that it gives me heartburn. Like it's a reasonable investment. I think
I call those the ones that even if they don't work, I'm willing to do because it's better to be there than not to be there. And it's like the amount I'm willing to lose on it. Does that make sense? That's kind of how I look at it.
I mean, you know, in any marketing program, there's always things that you're going to do where you just have to go into it eyes wide open. Like, hey, this is probably, I'm not going to be able to show a tangible result from this, but I know it's something that, you know, it's kind of like taking your vitamins. It's good for our business to be there. But, you know, especially with the trade show investments, because that's where the expense really comes in. Because with trade shows, you got your booth and your sponsorship.
Why?
You got to bring your team out and people play golf and dinners with clients and all that stuff. So those are going to be, you know, six figure marketing investments generally at the end of the show. But with that, we do a really good job of tracking how many conversations did we have? How many deals did we close?
Yeah.
And so that's an area where I know that the shows we go to are really, you know, producing revenue for our business. And, you know, the other way that I look at it too, it's like, you know, there are three events a year where all of our clients go to. And so what's the value of that? I mean, it's like, for us not to be there would be silly.
That's so funny, right? So what you have to look at, I love your thing of like, it's like taking your vitamins. You're right. You don't like take your vitamins and be like, whew, looking good, right? Like it's just, it's maintenance. It's like doing an oil change. And I think it's so funny how this like crazy desire to optimize everything has made us worse at marketing. Yeah. Because we like forget that a lot of it of marketing is just like getting your brand in front of the right people often across different mediums.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, it the investment takes a long time to really play out. I mean, one of the big investments we made at QA Symphony when I was there was in the Atlassian Summit. So Atlassian, you know, make Jira. Every year they would have this thing called the Atlassian Summit. They bring together all their clients. So essentially it was like, and we were a software company that integrated with Atlassian.
Tough.
And so it was everyone we would want to talk to in one place at one time. And it was a huge investment, right? It was for us at a time, we were a small startup. I mean, it was a six-figure investment for us.
Yeah.
And we got back from the Atlassian Summit the first year we did it. And, you know, we got a lot of leads, but nothing happened. And then about 18 months later, we closed three of the biggest deals in company history that were all sourced from the Atlassian Summit.
Of course.
And so so we started to know, okay, leads.
Did you buy the second year because you didn't close them until 18 months? Did you go back or did you not go back?
No, we went back.
Okay, good. Because
those deals were already, they were kind
they're
of
in pipeline.
Pipeline, and we finally recognized that, oh, these are, and those were six-figure deals for us, which at the time was a really good contract value. And so we realized certain kind of clients, it just takes, like if you go after enterprise clients, that's a 24-month sales cycle, 48-month sales cycle, right? You're not going to close those deals in six months.
I love that. That's how I thought clients is that never pause ad campaigns in times that are shorter than your sales cycle because you don't know if it worked or not.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that you just have to, you have to really look closely at, you know, who you're selling to and how do you need to kind of consistently be in front of them throughout the process. And so that's just something as a marketer, there's no formula for it.
No.
It's a hard thing sometimes to explain to your CEO and CFO. But you know, if you're doing the right things consistently over time, you know, it should produce results that you can then say, hey, well, we know we spent this, but look at this that we've generated on the back end. It's always going to be one-to-one, which is, it's what every CFO wants. Like I spent $100,000 in Google, I generated $1 million in revenue in January.
Right.
Right. That's what they want to hear. But the reality is those investments, you know, if you're doing it the right way, hopefully will pay out over time. And if they're not paying out over time, then you cut that budget and you put that money into something else.
I love it. Jeff, I can do this all day. Unfortunately, we got to let you go. But this has been amazing. For everybody who wants to follow along, Jeff, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can hit me up on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'll also do a quick plug, if you don't mind. I have a book coming out later this year, probably summertime. It's a perfect beach read for marketers. It's called How Not to Suck at Marketing.
I love it.
Yeah, and you could learn more about it at HowNotToSuckAtMarketing.com, the website. Go check that out and check out the book when it comes out.
Will do. Check it out, everybody. HowToNotSuckAtMarketing.com by Jeff Perkins. Thanks so much for being on the show, Jeff.
All right, Garrett. Thanks, man. Thanks for the candy.
Of course.